We have one last session here with John and Susan Harvath, who need no introduction at this point. And they're going to be doing a little conversation interview with Annette Kaufman, widow of Louis Kaufman. And I will let them give her a special introduction to wrap up our afternoon. Thank you. Here's John and Susan Harvath again.
Happy to be back. We're going to be talking about Louis Kaufman, and we're delighted that Annette was able to come to this conference. And Annette, of course, many of you may not realize it, but she was an accomplished and is an accomplished musician in her own right, and also has done a lot of musicological research with Louis. Just some biographical background. Louis was born in Portland, Oregon in 1905. He passed away just a few years ago. At age 10, he traveled the Western Pantages vaudeville circuit for 6 months as part of the act of the dancer Rosika, playing the violin while Rosika changed costumes for the last number, playing Brahms' G minor Hungarian dance. That started his career. While she danced, he also played the violin. He studied violin with Franz Kneisel from 1918 to 26 at the Institute of Musical Arts in New York City. He won the Naumburg Award in 1928. He was a member of a musical art quartet as a violist, and many people confuse him with Louis Kiefman, who took over from him in the 1930s after he married Annette and moved to the West Coast. But Louis played in the famous series of recordings that the musical art quartet made in the 1920s for Columbia, including part of the Schubert Centennial series. For those of you who are interested in looking up those recordings, we have them here in the archive. He made his recital debut in New York City in 1928. He married Annette in 1933. Annette was a student of David Saperton and then of James Friskin at the Institute of Musical Art, and later on studied with Madame Jean Blancard in Paris. She gave many recitals. They toured the country and Europe in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and recorded together. Louis was famous for having won the Grand Prix du Disque as being the first American violinist to record the four seasons of Vivaldi. Annette and Louis together rediscovered Opus 8, Opus 9 of Vivaldi, recorded them, concertized, gave premier performances of them. Louis recorded extensively from 1920s through 1975. We tracked them down to begin with because Louis recorded for Edison, and we were trying to find surviving Edison recording artists. He actually started out recording acoustically for the Jeanette label in the 20s when he was still a student, and then in the late 20s electrically for Edison, and then went on to the musical art recordings and went off to Hollywood, which Susan will talk about. I also wanted to mention some of the other many labels he recorded for: Columbia, Vox, Telefunken, Concert Hall, Loiseau Lear, Capitol, Masters of the Bow, and the Orion labels. He recorded with a number of composers and did a number of world premieres. I became familiar with him as a kid by having the Copland 78 set for Concert Hall, the Copland Violin Sonata that he recorded with Copland, and also the Stravinsky duo concertante that he recorded, marvelous recording. He gave the premieres of numerous new works, violin concertos by Anthony Collins, Leighton Lucas, Dag Wiren, Lars Eric Larsen, Henri Sauget, Robert Russell Bennett, Bohuslav Martinu. Had works by William Grant Still and Bennett composed for him, appeared as a soloist with a number of different composers, Poulenc, Millau. At any rate, a remarkable career, great violinist. Susan wanted to talk to you about his Hollywood work.
As John said, we were fortunate enough to track down the Kaufmans and initially get to know them because of the Edison research. And another one of my hats is I teach film history at Syracuse University. So this kind of doppelganger personality of Louis Kaufman really interested both of us. And our relationship that was struck up those many years ago has continued. Annette, I want to reassure you, Annette is a wonderful correspondent. We aren't necessarily on the same plane, but I want her to know that when she sends us stuff, they don't just go into a black hole. I have one of the many Xeroxed articles that she sent us, and this is something published in Masters of the Bow, and it's a profile of Louis in Hollywood. His is the cover story, and it says, "Weeping and Laughing for Hollywood." And it says, from London. But it's "Weeping and Laughing for Hollywood," published in London. And it says, "Virtuoso violinist Louis Kaufman reminisced about playing for the great Hollywood film composers. Through the miracle of videotape, you can enjoy these performances. I'm going to tell you in a minute some of the wonderful films that it was a concert master for. So therefore, also when you hear those violin solos, that's Louis Kaufman. And anyway, the article goes on to say how it all started and off to Hollywood, and Annette's going to fill us in on all of this. And then this is a clue, folks, playing for Scarlett and Rhett. You got it. He did it. Max Steiner, he started with, actually his first thing was Lubitsch's The Merry Widow, 1934, Maurice Chevalier, Jeanette MacDonald, landmark. All of these are available on videotape, thank God. And that started it all. And then he went over to RKO and did a number of things for Max Steiner. If you know anything about the great musical scores that came out of Hollywood, I will reinforce the idea that Max Steiner at RKO, with David O. Selznick being the producer in charge of production at that time, that's how the scores started. I mean, they brought that volume and that sophistication to the screen in terms of music, because sound had not come in that many years earlier. The Jazz Singers, 1927. At any rate, he went on to do, among other things, Intermezzo, the great film with Leslie Howard and Ingrid Bergman, Ingrid Bergman's first performance in the USA. And there's a lot of violin music in that, and I think I should reinforce one idea, that the solos in that actually were recorded with Tasha Seidel, the disc theme song, and he had to match much of that.
As Louis said, he had to be an actor just as much as anyone else in the films, imitating other people's styles at times.
And then he went on to do Charles Chaplin's Modern Times in 1936, The Great Dictator in 1940. An interesting note in here about Modern Times, which was Newman, the composer for that. It says, "Newman had me play with a mute on, very close to a microphone, separated from the main orchestra by a large screen. We thus achieved an unusual degree of clarity, with the muted violin soaring over the orchestral fabric." He also, in addition to The Great Dictator, did Monsieur Verdu with Chaplin. And you should know also that Chaplin, of course, was a composer. He was a musician, and he did the music. He composed those music for his films. Franz Waxman, The Bride of Frankenstein, started that relationship in 1935. Bernard Herrmann, Citizen Kane, listen to those violin solos. It says in here he did. Okay, well, it says Citizen Kane in the article, but we also know that he was in Magnificent Ambersons, too. And then going on to Korngold, and the list goes on and on from those early films, Rebecca, the 1935 Mutiny on the Bounty, Going My Way, 1936 Showboat, with Robert Russell Bennett doing the orchestrations, and all the way up to Hello, Dolly! And The Sound of Music. A nice long career. One final note is, when you look at a film like The Merry Widow and there is a close-up of the violinist, the solos are by Louis. The gypsy violinist is not Louis. in the film. They would have had to pay him extra money for that, and I just want to reinforce that because the man on the screen looks very scruffy, and Louis Kaufman never did. Okay. Without further ado, we're going to announce our friend and wonderful colleague, Annette Kaufman.
Thank you very much. What would you like me to tell you?
Why don't you start talking?
Sit at the table.
They have the microphone set up.
Yeah, the microphones are set up, and you can see us better than down with the people there. There's no light. And why don't you talk about how Louis got into movies?
Louis and I had very modest aims when we went to California. We didn't even think that the film studios there. We thought we'd play little concerts and we would, we happened to play for the radio. There was a very charming Nicaraguan man by the name of Jose Rodriguez who loved classic music. And there was a very popular newscast. Everybody listened to it in town. It was called the Ridgefield Reporter. He broadcast from 10 o'clock at night until 10:15, and then Mr. Rodriguez put us on from 10:15 to 10:30, and we were absolutely certain that as soon as the news was over, everybody turned off the radio. We thought, who's going to listen to, you know, classic music after the news? And we played for about 3 months. We did a few little concerts in towns around San Bernardino, Santa Barbara, you know, things like that. And Louis had some pupils. We thought we really had an ideal life. One morning, the telephone rang about 10 o'clock, and Louis answered, and there was a voice, and it said, "Are you Kaufman that plays on the radio?" And Louis said, "Yes." And he said, "I'm Mickey Whalen. I'm the contractor at MGM. And we tried out all the violinists in the orchestra, and we didn't like any of them. And Mr. Lubitsch heard you last night, and he'd like you to play." And Louis said, frankly, because he always said the truth, he said, "Frankly, I don't think I'd fit in. I'm a very serious musician. I played string quartets, and I, you know, play classic literature. And besides, I hear you work very long hours, and I don't think I'd like that." And Mr. Whalen couldn't believe that that was just an honest answer. He thought that Louis was very crafty. He thought he was asking for more money. And so he said, "Look, Mr. Kaufman, we'll pay you double union scale." Louis didn't know what single union scale was. And that didn't make any difference to him, but he said, "Why don't you try it out?" He said, "If we don't like you, we're not going to ask you again. And if you don't like us, you don't have to come back." So Louis looked at me and he said, "What do you think I should do?" I said, "Well, why don't you just see what it's like? It sounds like it might be interesting. And after all, you don't have to do it if you don't like it." So he went to work. They told him how to get to MGM. He just learned how to drive a car. But he passed without knowing how to back up. He'd never driven a car in his life. No need to drive a car in Europe or in New York, you know. So fortunately, when he passed the test, they didn't ask him to back up. Later he had a pupil who taught him how to back up because they taught driving in the California schools. And incidentally, he couldn't call me because they only had one telephone available for orchestral musicians on the set. And whenever he thought that he might get to the telephone, there was a huge queue. And so I really didn't hear from him. And he came home about 3 o'clock in the morning after going there, you know, at 9. So I was really worried. I didn't know if he'd been in an accident or what had happened. But in any case, he came in and he said, "Willy-nilly, dear, I've got to like this. I thought it over." He said, after all, it was Lehar's music, which is charming. It was Mr. Stoddart's very good musician, and they were very pleasant. And he said, "It pays too well." He said, "You know, I made $275. We were paying $35 a month for renting a house. we were getting $25 for playing a broadcast, and when they had us up to three a week, we were making $75. I mean, you know, money was no problem. But 275 was really a sum. And he said, we can have our own house, and there's nothing to stop us from doing what we want to do, seriously. And I have to say, Louis was never a person who ever thought of money in connection with music. He felt that if you wanted to be a millionaire, you looked for an oil well, or you looked for a mine, or you did something like that. But when you were in music, you know, you were supposed to do the best thing you could, and he felt that that was something that he was a success story in reverse, because he always wanted to do the thing that was the best, you know? And that's why we became, I have to tell you, we became friends with Bernard Herrmann, who was an enchanting character, and had a great love for every kind of music. When he had his CBS Symphony, he invited all of the European refugee composers to come and conduct. And he invited Mio when he came, and he invited Casanova Tedesco, and he invited Korngold. And when Korngold came, Ben Hyams told me, because I wasn't there at the time, that he cried when he conducted, because he didn't know if he was ever going to conduct again in his life, in any place, when he left Vienna. You know, it was so moving to have an orchestra offered to him. And Benny loved, you know, 19th century music, Waldteufel and stuff like that. He had a fascinating love of the obscure composers, Raff, and you know, he did very interesting things. And he liked to invite Louis to play works with him. And Louis was to play a concerto by a man by the name of, wait a minute, oh golly, I know it so well, a Russian, he wrote the Red Army song. What did I tell you his name was? It just slipped my mind. Knipper, that's right. He was the son of the actress Olga Knipper, thank you, and Chekhov, the writer. And he was a modest man, and he thought, you know, I don't want to use Chekhov, this celebrated writer's name. I'll just use my mother's name. She's an actress, and it's not all that, you know, arrogant for me to do that. And they called him, Louis, from CBS, and they said, look, Louis, Benny has to do a picture in Hollywood, and Antonini's going to conduct the orchestra, and Antonini doesn't want to do the Knipper, and he wants you to do four Vivaldi concertos that he got from Milan. Louis said, well, I'd rather play the Knipper, because I know the Knipper and I don't know the Vivaldi concertos. And Benny got on the phone and he said, Louis, I looked at the concertos, they're very interesting, you ought to learn them. So Louis said, well, all right, send me the music. And they sent the music, and in those days we traveled on the train, and you had a compartment so he could study them while he was going east. And a very amusing thing happened with this. On the train going to Chicago, I read in the New York Times, Louis was practicing, I read the New York Times, and it said that Poulenc was coming to this country, to America, and he was touring with Bernac, and they were doing a whole tour, and Louis was planning to play the Poulenc Sonata that's dedicated to the memory of Garcia Lorca, and he thought, this is a great chance to play it for Poulenc and see what if he likes it, you know, to tell me what he wants me to do. He always wanted to speak with composers, because, as you know, writing music is still a fairly indefinite thing. Interpretation is still a fairly indefinite thing. You really can't always put everything like you can on a computer. So it's good to find out what a composer really wants. It gives you an assurance. So I wrote a letter to the New York management. Louis mailed it at Tucson, giving our schedule, asking for Poulenc's schedule, if there was any place we could meet. We got a very nice letter by the time we reached Chicago. And it turned out that the day that we were still in Chicago, he was coming in. We were leaving the next day. It was just fate that we should both have one afternoon there, and that Mr. Poulenc would be very glad to see us and to go over the sonata with Louis. So this popped in the way, and Mr. Poulenc was very nice to us. He came into the hotel lobby. He said, vous êtes Kaufmann, je vous connais par votre violon. He said, you're Kaufmann, I know you by your violin. And so we had to search through the hotel, find a piano. There was an old rattletrap piano that was painted all gilt in the ballroom, and a lot of old drums and percussion things hanging around. And they went through it twice, and Poulenc liked it very the way he told Louis, said it's Cante Hondo, play it, you know, very a la gypsy. And Louis did that, by the way, when he played it in New York, and there was only one critic who wrote, he said, Kaufman's all right as a violinist, but he certainly didn't understand what Poulenc had in mind.
Talk about the recording session of Vivaldi.
So I have to tell you about the Vivaldi. My mind wanders, excuse me, I'm an old lady. So in any case, Louis learned the Sam Josephowitz had called Louis just before we got on the train to go to New York for the concert where he played the Poulenc. And he said, there's going to be a strike, Louis, and we're trying to do some repertoire. And have you got anything you could do with small orchestra? So Louis said, well, CBS is sending me 4 Vivaldi concertos, and I'll be in New York in December, and we can do them then, because the records had to be made before December 31st. Well, Carnegie Hall was taken from all during the day, and it was incredible. They had the Philadelphia Orchestra, the New York Orchestra, the Boston Symphony, the Baltimore Orchestra. Everybody was using Carnegie Hall. The only time they could get was from midnight to 3 o'clock in the morning. So it also had the greatest snowstorm since 1886, which complicated matters. And we had a harpsichordist whose name was Edith Weissmann, and Louis thought he should have a rehearsal with Edith. And she had a harpsichord. There were only 7 Steingrabers in the world, and she had it all covered with blankets. In New York apartments, they're very warmly heated, and she was going to go into this snow, and the New York police weren't, the snow people hadn't been alerted because they said it would just be a small snow. And so it was just like being blanketed. Cars were stuck in the middle of the street with snow up to the top, you know. And the New York police said you could only go north and south. You couldn't have any east and west travel. So here is Madame Weissmann with her harpsichord. She took it on a truck to Columbus Circle, and they had to put it on a hand truck. And then she, all of the time, had a thermometer taking its temperature. And she got in, they finally got it into Carnegie Hall, and she sat with it all day taking its temperature till 12 o'clock. It was really remarkable. Well, any case, we had the New York Philharmonic, but they couldn't say that because they were under contract to somebody else, so they called it the Concert Hall Orchestra. And there was a wonderful old violinist, Mr. Henry Svoboda, a Czech refugee, conducted, and there was a wonderful old violinist there, Emil Hauser. He was, I think, the first violinist of the original Budapest Quartet. And when the last morning we finished it, just the morning of December 31st. Incidentally, the musicians were enchanted. Bernard Greenhouse, who was the cellist, said at one point when the third concerto has a vintner's dance festival, and they're supposed to be in a sort of drunken sleep. He said they just discovered everything in the 18th century. He was just overwhelmed. And we had Edward Niesberger, who had worked with Dr. Schweitzer on Bach editions. He played the organ as if it had been a reed organ. He just had wonderful voices for everything. Did you hear me? John thinks I'm not close. In any event, Mr. Hauser said to me at the end of the session, he said, Mrs. Kaufman, this music's going to go around the world. It was the Four Seasons. He was a lovely old man, and I certainly wasn't going to say anything impolite. I just nodded, and I told Louis later, I said, you know, he said the funniest thing to me. He said, this music's going to go around the world. Nobody's going to ever hear of this music. It's a little company concert hall. They'll put out a small edition. And curiously enough, Mr. Hauser was right. Today there are 90 versions. But I was going to also say that the Josephowitz brothers, who own Concert Hall, had connections. They'd studied in Switzerland. They'd studied in book collecting and all of that, and they decide to go into a record company. And so they sent it to their friends in Paris, and they sent it to their friends in Switzerland and, you know, all over. And there was a wonderful man in Paris by the name of Mark Pancherl. He was the greatest authority on Vivaldi. He wrote a great, wonderful book on Vivaldi. And Mark Pancho was on the board of the Société Charles Gros for, I was going to say enregistrement, I mean for recording, and they gave it the Grand Prix de Disque. Well, that really set us off, you know. It was, that's how we happened to go to Europe and make more recordings.
Okay. Annette, can you talk a little bit about some of the Hollywood composers that Louis worked with? I mean, here at Syracuse, for instance, we have Franz Waxman's estate, we have Miklos Rozsa's.
Oh, that's wonderful. Recordings. Well, I can tell you, all the Viennese are charming. There isn't any such thing as an uncharming Viennese, from Lotta Lehmann to Max Steiner and all of those people. Max was an enchanting personality. He had a wonderful wit, and he invented, as Louis said, a wonderful way of using thematic material so that it expressed the emotions and the sentiments of the people. He really sort of set out a pattern for people to use. And Louis used to tell a story because it showed how Max saved pictures. They made the original of Human Bondage of Somerset Maugham by just putting any old soundtracks to it. And it was shown in a preview, and the audience just howled. They thought it was hilarious that this lame, poor boy was being treated so badly by this nasty little waitress. And the studio saw all their money going down the drain. They were very upset about it, and they called in Max. He wrote a psychological score that showed the anguish of this poor man and the whole story. And as Louis said, it put you in an emotional vice, and the picture became a tremendous success. It made a star out of Betty Davis instead of a laughing stock, and, you know, as it had been with this wrong music. And he did marvelous scores. Louis played in Since You Went Away, he played in, I can't think, he played in all those, Steiner, and he did wonderful things with Steiner, those musical comedies, you know, with Fred Astaire, which had delicious music. He had a real Lehar touch. It was very pleasant working with Max. He had a lovely disposition with the orchestra, and if people didn't orchestrate the way he envisaged, he would call out on the set, you know, things like, that isn't played by the woodwinds, let the bassoon play it, or he would say, this isn't right, don't have the flute play it, have it played
so,
by
so cello. Would all composers be on the set like that during a recording session?
Yes, they would have a copyist, and they'd hurry up and do it. But he worked on the first Waxman film, which was the Bride of Frankenstein. He worked a lot with Franz on Suspicion and on a picture that was called Sayonara. Mm-hmm. Franz wanted a kind of an exotic sound, and so Louis said, well, I'll play it on the viola, and that'll give it a different timbre. You know, you won't find that.
Now, Louis worked for the Disney films. He had to do unusual things for those.
Oh, incidentally, someone just told me in Hollywood that they've put up a big plaque of the musicians who played in Disney films, and they have Louis down. His name is there, because he played in Pinocchio, and he played in Cinderella, and then there was something else, another one about the Three Bears or something.
Tell us about, I mean, he actually used click tracks with Disney. Do you remember that?
What?
Using click tracks with the Disney films?
Well, the Disney's always worked with click tracks. Click track was a device that you put on your ears that had a metronome time. They sometimes used it with running horses, or Disney used it all the time because those little characters had to move in a certain time. Louis once had to play part of the Tchaikovsky concerto over at MGM in a silly story about a blonde who didn't know which of three gentlemen she preferred. And she was
This is the Maisie series. This is the Maisie series with Ann Southern.
And she, then he had to play the Tchaikovsky, the sections they chose with click tracks. And then when he saw it with the picture, he said to the producer, "She isn't moving her fingers. She's holding the violin neck like a baseball bat." He said, somebody told her that you move your arm, you see. And they said, "Oh, Louis, don't be picky. Nobody will notice that. Nobody will notice that."
Annette, of all the Hollywood composers that Louis worked with, did he feel an especial affinity with anybody? Or?
Tell us about, he actually used click tracks with Disney. Do you remember that?
What?
Using click tracks with the Disney films?
Well, the Disney's always worked with click tracks. The click track was a device that you put on your ears that had a metronome time. They sometimes used it with running horses, or Disney used it all the time because those little characters had to move in the certain time. Louis once had to play part of the Tchaikovsky concerto over at MGM in a silly story about a blonde who didn't know which of three gentlemen she preferred. And she was
this
shown
is the
to
Maisie
play the violin.
Series. This is the Maisie series with Ann Southern.
And she he had to play the Tchaikovsky, the sections they chose, with click tracks. And then when he saw it with the picture, he said to the producer, "She isn't moving her fingers. She's holding the violin neck like a baseball bat." He said, somebody told her that you move your arm, you see. And they said, "Oh, Louis, don't be picky. Nobody will notice that. Nobody will notice that."
Annette, of all the Hollywood composers that Louis worked with, did he feel an especial affinity with anybody?
Well, he was good friends with everybody. Louis had a very friendly nature. I wanted to say something about Alfred Newman, because Alfred Newman was a very talented boy from, I think, Hartford, Connecticut. And he played piano very well. He once even played a concert with Louis and some colleagues. He played the Dohnányi piano quintet. And he also played a Mozart quintet with him at a concert that they did in Los Angeles for a Pro Music Society. But Alfred had a wonderful conducting technique. Reiner was very interested in him and thought he could have had a virtuoso conductor's career. And his orchestra, Louis played for him for years, had really virtuoso players, woodwinds, horns, trombones or horns, but every type of player was awfully good. And Al really worried about performance. With Steiner and with Korngold and with people like that, they liked a good performance, but the performance wasn't the be-all and end-all for them, but it was for Al. Mm-hmm. He had a wonderful beat. And people like Roger, who was a wonderful gentleman and a wonderful conductor and a very fine composer, they all had a wonderful knowledge of the orchestra and its components and what you can do. We have today quite a lot of young people who don't know what an orchestra can do. They don't know that a violin can play double stops, or they don't know what a horn can do, or things like that. So there's a certain monotony in a lot of the scores, And there's a lot of aleatory playing where, when you have murders and all sorts of mayhem and cars crashing, so then anybody plays just whatever they like, It doesn't make any difference.
Annette, what about Bernard Herrmann in those Hitchcock films?
Oh,
Vertigo and Rear Window.
Herrmann was remarkable. He was the only person who orchestrated his own music. He insisted on that, and that caused a lot of bad feeling among orchestrators. Most of the, when they had sort of factory system. Everybody had a certain production that they did a great deal of, and so there was a tremendous product coming out. And the composers like Steiner and even Franz and Korngold, they couldn't always do it all themselves. There's an awful lot of notes to write. It was before, and they wouldn't have thought of using computers, So that they had to
parcel it out. But Bernard Herrmann did his own orchestrations, and they were always very imaginative and very wonderful and very unusual. He could do things. I remember Norman Corwin telling us one time when he was doing a program they were doing sort of biblical things, and he was so excited because they usually didn't get much money for an orchestra at CBS. And he came to Benny and he said, you know, we can have a big orchestra. And Benny said, this is about Samson. You know, he said, there wasn't a big orchestra there in the desert. And he just said, I want some harps, you know, and a couple of drums. And Norman, you know, thought that's crazy. You know, here we have a chance. We could have the whole orchestra and make a great success. And it was absolutely wonderful. When you hear that broadcast, it's sheer magic, you know, how what he did with it. So he was I don't really see how he had the patience to write down, you know, all of those millions and millions of notes, but he did, he got the color he wanted, and he wrote very imaginative scores for all of the films that he worked on. And Louis always found it a delight to work with him, because he was full of, he was a very well-read, and he was full of all sorts of marvelous stories about composers. I remember one time we were in New York when he was conducting an orchestra, and he wanted all the string players except the cellos to stand up, and they said, no, we're not going to stand up. And he said, just try it and see what happens. And he'd read someplace that von Bülow had all the strings and violas stand up, and a lot of the orchestra, you know, flutes and the people that could hold them up. And finally he got them to stand up. And what a difference it made. I mean, everybody played like an artist, you know? All the violinists were playing as if they were Heifetz. Things were going on like that. So his ideas were always very fresh and very interesting.
Can you talk a little bit about Robert Russell Bennett? Because he orchestrated Showboat.
Oh,
he
did, yes.
And he was a composer in his own right that composed for Louis.
Yes, he did orchestrations for Oscar Hammerstein, and he did them for Oscar Hammerstein too, and Richard Rodgers on all those things. And he did all the orchestrations for Jerome Kern. He was a wonderful man. He came from Kansas. He could play a piano very well. We happened to be invited to a dinner that Roy Webb, who was also an adequate, very fine composer, gave for him. And I'm not telling the story that you want. You want the story about recording for Showboat. Louis was the concertmaster, and there was another violinist sitting with him who wasn't very adaptable, and it was something for two violins. And so he said, Louis, you play both lines. And Louis said, you'll be sorry. And he said, no, I don't think I will. And Louis did it in one take, and it was all right. But in any case, they had a party for him, and Louis was sitting next to him at this little dinner that was with Cy Mockridge, who was a very interesting man. He'd accompanied Maggie Tate, that will interest all of you, who had a lovely voice and did wonderful singing. And Louis said, you know, it'd be awfully nice, Russell, if you'd write some pieces for violin that are in the popular idiom. And 2 days later, Sunday morning, he said, Louis, come over and get your piece. Louis said, what piece? He said, what was all the campaign you were giving me the other night about wanting pieces for violin? And he had written a small group of pieces called Hexapoda, or Five Studies in Jitteroptera, and they were Betty and Harold Close Their Eyes, Jim Jives, Till Dawn Sunday, Gut Bucket Gus. They had very colorful titles, and he Louis said, would you play it with me in New York? And Russell said, sure. He said, I'm going to be there. We're opening Oklahoma. I have to be there for the opening. He did all the orchestrations. And so Louis played it with him, and they were a very amusing group, because Russell was about 6'4" and Louis was about 5'4". He towered over him, you know. They looked sort of like Mutt and Jeff. And they had to repeat a couple of pieces. It got a great deal of attention. And Heifetz heard about it, and when we were invited for some chamber music the following summer, he said, Louis, when you come down to play, he was living at Balboa, he says, bring along that Hexapoda piece, I'd like to hear it. So we, after an afternoon of playing Mozart and Brahms and whatever, we trotted out the music and played it for Heifetz, and he liked it very much. He says, you know, I'm going to play it. So we sent Russell, recorded it for Decca. Then later, Russell wrote a fiddle concerto for Louis, which Benny Herman liked very much. Louis played it for CBS with Benny a couple of times, and he also played it with Benny when Benny did some concerts in London at the Royal Festival Hall with the London Symphony Orchestra. It made a very good impression. He wrote a sonata, a song sonata for Louis, and Heifetz also later played that, so we were awfully pleased.
I think we're going to open it up for questions from you, but I thought this would be appropriate. This is from the article I cited on Hollywood, and this is Louis recalling a quote from Korngold, who I guess had the same kind of propensity that Sam Goldwyn did for kind of malapropisms and funny little things. Anyway, in view of what people were saying in some of the sessions today, I thought this was kind of funny. Korngold said, even a great performance can't spoil a fine composition.
He did. We agreed with it.
Any questions from you? Any questions?
Yeah. Questions from the audience.
Republic Pictures seem to be a training ground for some of the best people in Hollywood. Do you have any recollections or any comments about that?
No, but they did very interesting pictures, and they had some good people over there. I think that, you see, when we first came out, we were sort of in the what they call the Golden Age. It was a time when they didn't have regular studio orchestras. After a few years, they had regular studio orchestras, and then Louis didn't roam the field anymore like that. He would play either at, by a curious thing of fate, he played for a time at United Artists, and then at 20th Century Fox and at Paramount, and then at he ended up at Warner Brothers, where they had Korngold, Roja was at MGM. They had Korngold and Voxman, and some very interesting people. Mm-hmm. It was a very fine.
Other questions.
Did he do anything with the screaming violins in Herman's Psycho?
Sure.
Yeah.
Is that him?
Sure.
That's a very important part of that film.
Yes, yes. He had an idea, you know. He didn't always want it beautiful. He wanted it effective, which was, of course, interesting. Yeah.
The third time I saw that film, I was sitting in an audience. There was a girl about three seats down from me that the scene with Balsam coming up the stairs. As soon as that screeching started, she screamed in the exact same pitch as the violin.
Isn't that amazing?
That's when I realized what it was.
Yes.
That was a cue to the audience to scream.
That's right.
It's interesting, right. With respect to Psycho, Turn the sound off on some of that. I mean, when I think of screeching violins, I think when Janet Leigh is fleeing the police and she's in the car, and all you see, you know, like three standard shots from behind and in the rearview mirror and in front of her with the windshield wipers going, and you hear this jagged violin line, and you know, and it's wonderful, agitato at its best. Try looking at that scene with that off. Nothing.
Just driving the car.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's like what Louis told us again. He was an actor like anyone else on the screen.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
You remember the name Sam Hayes?
Yes.
Yeah. He was that announcer on the news broadcast that you followed.
Isn't that it? I'm so glad to know.
Good for you. Wonderful.
Fascinating.
Any other questions about any other Hollywood composers that you were interested in hearing about, or any musicians in Hollywood? Because Louis and Annette knew all of them.
Yeah.
So if you
Hugo Friedhofer was a very fine orchestrator and composer. Louis did several of his pictures, Boy and a Dolphin, and
Story
of Marco Polo.
Yeah. Here's a question.
left field, since he was at Warner Brothers during this period, was he playing for the cartoons when Carl Stalling was in that?
I imagine he probably did all of it, you know. It was a sort of a mill with a lot of stuff to grind, you know, at that time.
Yes.
What kind, this is a place where diaries might be very interesting. Do you have a collection of his scheduling during this period? Because it may be possible to link him up with some of the other films.
Yeah, he used to keep a sort of date book where he knew that he had to be at certain places.
And so do you still have that in it?
There are several of them. There were 14 years.
Good.
You know. Yes, there might. Yeah. I was going to say, for example, on that picture intermezzo, Tasha made a disc that was used for the main title and for the end title. And Louis did all the other playing, but it was not easy to match Tasha, you know? And it was a real tough job.
Because we heard that recording.
Gorgeous.
By the way, Annette has just finished writing out Louis's memoirs, and she's trying to find a publisher now. So a lot of this information, we hope, will be in there.
Louis had a heart attack and wasn't, being diverted by much, so I got a tape machine and had him talk into it, and so it's really his memoirs, you know, and then I'd read it to him, because after all, we don't write as we talk, you know, we repeat things when we talk, and that sort of thing, and he sort of edited it, so it was all right.
Any other questions?
Do you know anything about Nat Finston?
Nat Finston?
Yes, he was a business manager of, I don't remember whether it was...
He's at Paramount.
At Paramount, certainly he did. Yes.
And that told us
most
a lot
of those business managers were very nice fellows. You know, they tried to get the best orchestras they could, and they tried to get the best arrangers. It was a time of innocence. Everybody wanted people to look nice, to speak nicely, to do a very good job. Sometimes they did too good a job. The hairdressers made everybody look alike, and, you know,
Annette was saying,
which girl it was.
Yeah. Oh, Annette was saying that a lot of the credits would say musical director, but very often they were just heads of the music departments who took the credit for other people's work.
Well, in a way, they weren't. The studios were ill-informed. They didn't know that there were such things as right for composers. Bernard Herrmann and Rozsa, Anthony Collins from England, they first got the idea. The original contracts that composers had to sign said that everything belonged to the studio, that everything belonged to, no matter what, what rights would come along. And it was Rozsa and Tony Collins and Bernard Herrmann who said, no, look, this isn't right. We should have rights. There's a performing rights society in England. There's a performing rights society in France. And, you know, you should have performing rights here. It was rather like publishers. I could tell you a very funny story. ASCAP didn't know, they had to join ASCAP, you had to have 5 tunes. When the composers came from Europe, people like Mio or like Toch or like Schoenberg, they didn't have 5 tunes. They had symphonies, string quartets, all sorts of things. George Gershwin deserves the credit for this, because George went to the ASCAP and said, these are composers, they should belong to the organization. And so that's how they got in.
Okay, we have no more questions.
More time.
Unfortunately, time is up. So if anyone wants to ask questions, come up to Annette after.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Don't get up yet. They will be at the banquet tomorrow, and I'm sure there are more stories and more questions. Don't move. Just 1 minute. Bill, put your hat on. The guy, put your hat on so we all know who Bill is. Bill is going to start us. Oh, boy. Start us off upstairs, directly above where we are now. Go up the stairs into the lobby, and don't move yet. Let me finish. Go upstairs for Bill to tell us something about the theater, and I think we're all going to go as a group since we're running late, and we'll just sort of be, let him be the Pied Piper, tell us and show us, and then head out and look for some dinner.
What are we doing?
8 o'clock, we will have films in the theater.
And that train leaves at 10?
The train goes at 10 o'clock.
So we just walk down to the station there and there'll be a train.
Yes.
Question for the for tomorrow. Is there any access to your office?
You can come in and use Microsoft Word.
Okay.
We don't